And let me invite to you now the third speaker, somebody whom I know from times immemorial, from times before the Iron Curtain fell, from spring 1991, Michael Jones, now Professor Emeritus from Trondheim. What else can I say, Mike? A geographer. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Elvis.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Mine is a rather different presentation from the two previous. People's attachments to landscapes are expressed in different ways. These different ways include people's practices in the landscape and people's representations of landscape. The language of landscape comprises stories that people tell about landscape, as we've seen. It comprises the names they give to places and to landscape features, and the terminology that they use to describe landscape. In my paper today, I will be examining two terms used in landscape management. One is cultural landscape, and the other is landscape democracy. Cultural landscape became a frequently used term among landscape managers in the 1980s and 1990s. Landscape democracy gained currency after the signing of the European Landscape Convention in 2000. So the question that I'm posing is whether these two terms indicate a change from authoritarian to pluralistic landscape management. But first, a few words about David Löwenthal. Today we're commemorating David Löwenthal's long life. As a founding father of heritage studies, David was concerned with what people choose from past landscapes to pass on to future generations. And this unavoidably involves processes of selection, whether conscious or unconscious. David argued that heritage is not the same as history. Heritage is what people choose from history to define themselves. Heritage involves telling stories, and these narratives are part of the language of landscape. I got to know David from about the time he was appointed to the Geography Department at University College London in 1972, the same year that I completed my PhD there. I didn't get to know him well to begin with, as I was working in Finland at the time, and later from 1973 in Norway. However, I met David through the years at various conferences, among them several in Norway. In 1998, David attended the European Landscape Conference in Røros and Trondheim, for which I was convener. David had a strong interest in islands, and he took part in a memorable post-conference excursion to Sula, a small island community off the coast of central Norway. He was in his element. Then in 2002-2003, he made an important contribution as a member of the research group on landscape, law and justice, which I led at the Centre for Advanced Studies. Ken Olvik was also a member of the group. David's publications were always thought-provoking. We are familiar with the titles such as The Past is a Foreign Country and The Past is a Foreign Country Revisited, The Heritage Crusade and the Spoils of History, and the edition with the framed, rather telling frame in the middle, Possessed by the Past. However, I'm taking as my starting point a small publication, a short article published in the UNESCO Courier by David in September 1997, titled Cultural Landscapes. David wrote his article not long after cultural landscapes as World Heritage Sites were included in the UNESCO operational guidelines in 1995. According to these guidelines, categories of cultural landscape include first designed and intentionally created landscapes such as gardens and parks constructed for aesthetic reasons. Secondly, they include organically evolved landscapes, both relict or fossil landscapes such as mining landscapes, of the type that we have in Røros in Norway, or continuing landscapes with traditional ways of life. David gave the examples of Somerset Levels and the Yorkshire Dales. Thirdly, associative cultural landscapes, natural elements with religious, artistic or cultural associations. The first two were the Tongariro National Park in New Zealand and the Uluru Park in Australia, both places of particular significance for Indigenous peoples. In his article, David was concerned first with the problems of making a selection of such landscapes for inscription on the World Heritage List. How do we determine what is of universal value? But he was also concerned with the danger that listing some landscapes as World Heritage might signal to governments and to entrepreneurs that they were at liberty to do as they like with landscapes that were not on the list. So by calling the landscapes one thing, you were also saying something about what might happen in landscapes outside that area. The term cultural landscape is something that I've long had an interest for. I published a series of articles between 1988 and 2003 dealing on how the concept of cultural landscape has various usages, both in research and management. But first, just a brief history of the term, without going into too much detail. The term Kulturlandschaft appeared in German geographical literature in the early 19th century. It was first used by the geographer Karl Ritter in 1832. It was used by several German geographers in the 1850s and again in the 1880s, and most notably by Friedrich Ratzel, both in 1880 and in the 1890s, and by others later. The term Kulturlandschaft had various connotations, but it described a variety of processes whereby the physical environment was modified by human activity. The concept was introduced into the English-speaking world in Carl Sauer's seminal work, The Morphology of Landscape, in 1925, and was part of the guidelines almost for the Berkeley School of Geography. Carl Sauer was David Lowenthal's advisor for his master degree at the end of the 1940s. Well, I don't have time to discuss the debate between Carl Sauer and Richard Hartshorn on the cultural landscape concept, but my focus has been on how the cultural landscape concept has been used in the Nordic countries, especially Norway. It began to be used by Nordic geographers in several countries at the same time. In Norway, it was the geographer Ordel Brun Tjudi in 1934-35. In Finland, the geographer Helmer Schmedes in 1935 in his doctoral thesis. My own PhD thesis dealt with Finland, and Schmedes was my first advisor in Finland until his untimely death in 1968. About the same time, the ethnologist Orka Campbell adopted the term cultural landscape in Sweden. On my part, I first became aware of the cultural landscape in the very first lecture of my first year undergraduate course in human geography at UCL in 1963. There it was defined in the classical sense of Ratzel and Sauer as the landscape modified by human activity. I used it when I began teaching in Trondheim in 1975 at the University of Trondheim. Initially, it seemed unproblematical, but I soon discovered that the term was being used in different fields to mean different things. And this led me to think about who has the power to define a concept. To have command of definition is to have control of discourse, wrote David N. Livingstone in the Geographical Tradition in 1992. Geographers seem to be attracted to complex concepts, such as landscape, cultural landscape, nature, environment, place, space, concepts that can be defined in many different ways, leading to endless discussion. The geographer Andrew Sayer in 1984 wrote that these were chaotic concepts. They should be avoided because they are inimical to precise and unambiguous scientific thought. However, for others, they are cherished concepts which capture the complexity of the real world. In my work, I have distinguished between authoritarian and pluralistic or democratic definitions of concepts. To claim that a single unambiguous definition of a concept is the correct definition, necessary for logical argument and clarity of thought, may be characterized as an authoritarian definition when it does not accept other definitions and usages of the same term. An alternative approach is to find out how and why a particular term is used in different contexts. Systematic presentation of a term's different meanings can, in fact, also promote better communication and dialogue by making users aware of the differences in their understanding of the concepts behind the same terms. I have termed this approach pluralistic or democratic. A growing awareness that the term cultural landscape was being used with a number of different meanings led me in 1988 to undertake a literature search to investigate various definitions of cultural landscape in Norway. This was based on a survey of literature, academic and planning literature from 1934 to 1988, and identified seven principal definitions, which I then grouped into three main forms of understanding. The first group is cultural landscape understood as landscape as modified by human activity, the classical definition of Ratzel in Germany and Sauer in the United States. But here it could be sometimes considered as an aerial category, sometimes considered as a chronological stage of development, and sometimes used to describe the human components of any landscape. The second group was cultural landscape understood as valued features of the human landscape that were threatened by change. This might be the countryside threatened by urbanisation. It might be heritage, ancient monuments, ancient buildings threatened by modernisation. Or it might be scenery threatened by dramatic change. The third grouping are elements in the landscape with a particular meaning and significance for human activity. And these vary according to cultural or socio-economic context. Each cultural group, each socio-economic group will think that different elements in the landscape are important and significant for what they do. In 1999, the Norwegian Research Council initiated a government-sponsored applied research programme on cultural landscape. When the applications started coming in, the steering group found that the different usages of the term cultural landscape was highly confusing. I was then commissioned to lead a study of its usages in administrative and applied research documents. Together with my PhD student at that time, Caroline Dogstad, we analysed over 40 published documents issued between 1987 and 1993. And we identified four discourses on cultural landscape. First was the discourse going on in the agricultural sector. For agriculturalists, the cultural landscape was cultivated land plus environmental goods produced by agriculture. They emphasised economic values and, secondarily, some ecological and cultural historical values. In the nature conservation sector, cultural landscape was human influenced or semi-natural ecosystems. The nature conservationists emphasised ecological values, biodiversity, and, secondarily, aesthetic and cultural historical values. In the cultural heritage sector, cultural landscape was landscape modified by humans, especially ancient monuments and historic buildings. Here, of course, cultural historical values were paramount, plus aesthetic values. Then in local planning documents, cultural landscape meant green areas. Aesthetic values were paramount, plus historical, cultural and ecological values. This was in the 1980s and 1990s when there was a strong focus on cultural landscape as a set of values to be maintained by landscape management. Since then, this focus has given way to other concepts such as biodiversity, ecosystem services and sustainable landscapes, each of which pose their own problems of definition. Despite different usages and terms, the various administrative sectors have tended towards a top-down, authoritarian definitions. However, since around 2000, nature conservation and cultural heritage authorities and other planning and management agencies have begun to pay attention to public participation as necessary to give legitimacy to their decisions. So we turn then to landscape democracy, a new concept which has appeared since 2000. But what type of democracy is landscape democracy? Is it, as illustrated on the left, to do with parliamentary democracy, to do with the constitution? On the left is the parade held every year on the 17th of May in all Norwegian towns. And this was 17th of May 2014, the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Norwegian Constitution, which eventually led to the foundations for parliamentary democracy in Norway. Or is landscape democracy extra-parliamentary democracy, as claimed by protesters demonstrating against the anti-Vietnam War in London on the 27th of October in 1968? The concept of landscape democracy is linked to the European Landscape Convention, the Florence Convention of 2000, enforced 2004, now ratified by 39 members of the Council of Europe, signed by two others but not ratified, and still not signed by six members, among them Germany, Austria and Russia. The convention itself does not mention landscape democracy as such, but it contains several innovative features which might be considered as an implicit landscape democracy. We are all familiar with the new definition of landscape as an area perceived by people whose character is the result of the interaction and action and interaction of natural and or human factors. An area as perceived by people. Secondly, the convention applies to all landscapes, not just certain selected cultural landscapes as in the UNESCO definition. Thirdly, the convention points to the value of diversity, diversity of cultures, diversity of landscapes. Fourthly, landscape is not an exclusive field for specialists, but is everybody's concerned. Fifthly, the convention emphasises enhanced public participation. It also emphasises subsidiarity, whereby decisions should be made at the lowest practicable administrative level. The term landscape democracy made its appearance not in the convention, but in the explanatory report published the same year, 2000. There it was placed on the agenda without clear definition or without definition at all. It appears in paragraph 64 of the explanatory report, allowing local actors throughout Europe to take part and thus creating a true landscape democracy, referring to information exchange through electronic communication in a rather technocratic context. In fact, the whole explanatory report is rather technocratic. However, in 2008, some new guidelines were published for the implementation of the European Landscape Convention. And here, democracy is counterpoised to expert dominance. Paragraph 2.23a says, the concept of landscape proposed by the convention implies an exercise in democracy, whereby differences are accepted, common characteristics found, and operational compromises eventually reached. These represent an alternative to the drawing up by experts of hierarchical classifications of landscape qualities. Landscape democracy has most often been used in connection with public participation, which, as I've said, is strongly emphasised in the European Landscape Convention. In 2008, together with a Swedish colleague, Maria Stensiker, I arranged a workshop on public participation in landscape matters at the European Landscape Conference in Portugal, which resulted in a book published in 2011, The European Landscape Convention, Challenges of Participation. This dealt with participation theory and lessons from 12 European examples. It provided positive examples of good practice, but it also focused on the problems of participation, the fact that public participation is time-consuming and costly, the fact that apathy and social barriers can impede people's involvement, the fact that aims of different stakeholders can be incompatible. The fact that public participation can be manipulated by powerful interest groups. This has been called the tyranny of participation. The fact that in practice, participatory exercises are often steered top down rather than bottom up. And not least, that public participation has a very unclear relationship to representative democracy. There are a variety of methods of public participation carried out in different countries, but in many cases, little has been done to implement them in the outcomes of planning, which primarily depend on the decisions of politically elected bodies. So how is public participation and politically elected bodies intended to meet? Well, landscape democracy is much more than public participation. At the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, Department of Landscape Architecture, the Centre for Landscape Democracy was established in 2014. The mission statement describes landscape democracy in a manner that is much broader than public participation. Landscape democracy is concerned with the relationship between landscape and democratic society. It's concerned with linkages between human rights, landscape, democracy, and public policy interventions. Landscape is then to be investigated as the spatial materialization of democracy, with a focus on the role of democratic values in protecting, managing, and planning landscape. Following a series of studies between 1977 and 2007 on the outcome of planning on landscapes in Trondheim, which I undertook together with colleagues and master students, I have, in more recent publications, been trying to understand different theoretical notions of democracy in order to understand democracy's relations to landscapes. I came up with this conceptual model, which is intended to provide an analytical tool for understanding how differing institutions of democracy, which are the dark blue boxes, interact in influencing landscape or influencing the outcomes in landscapes of conflicts and decisions. The relative weight given to the different institutions in any given situation can have a direct effect on how landscape issues are tackled and how conflicts are resolved or not, as the case may be. It's important to emphasise there's no simple causal relationship between a particular institution and a particular outcome. I've tried to indicate various normative dimensions in red along the margins. At the bottom margin, it's the radical dimension. On the left margin, it's the conservative dimension. The upper margin, it's the liberal dimension. And I see that it's fallen out in the overhead somehow, but on the right margin, there should be in red the populist dimension. The diagram may perhaps help why public participation, in accordance with the European Landscape Convention, which I've placed bottom left, how it is often not successful in influencing outcomes and hence is felt unsatisfactory for participants. But I'd also like to emphasise, with the help of this diagram, that different notions and institutions of democracy all have particular advantages and disadvantages. Bottom-up initiatives are actions by citizen and community groups, as well as by various interest groups, stakeholders. They range from spontaneous action to dialogue-based participatory planning. But there are a number of problems. One of them is how representative are such groups for a wider population, and how representative are the leaders of such groups actually for the group. There are power relations within such groups. There are issues of inclusion and exclusion. Another problem is often is a lack of dispute resolution procedures. And then governing authorities often ignore bottom-up initiatives. Top-down consultation, moving round towards the left, anti-clockwise. Governing authorities, top-down consultation focuses on defined stakeholders. But this also has a number of problems. How are the relevant stakeholders defined? Does consulting stakeholders mean that one ignores citizens at large? There's a problem that developers and planners may use consultation to further their own agendas. There's a danger of tokenism or placation rather than genuine consultation. A bit too early. There are bureaucratic decisions made by civil servants and administrators in interpreting and implementing government policies and the laws or decisions of elected bodies. Here problems may be managerialism and rigid adherence to rules. Bureaucrats may have excessive influence on implementation of decisions, and decisions often overlook minority interests. Turning to elective bodies, these are legislative bodies at different administrative levels, reflecting the majority will of the people. Problems we can mention here include possible electoral bias through unfair franchise or through gerrymandering. There may be uneven campaign financing. There may be unequal access to or control of the media. There may be conflict between electoral bodies at different levels. And there is an unclear relationship to referendums, as we've seen with Brexit. Part of this unclear relationship is whether referendums are advisory or not, and if you can ignore an advisory referendum. Moving around to market forces, these are consumer interests and businesses. This is also a form of democracy in the sense that markets reflect people's will, but it's based on their willingness to pay. However, differing abilities to pay maintain social inequality. For business, it is profitability rather than the interests of society at large that necessarily is the overriding concern of business, even if some businesses are philanthropic. You have lobbying by powerful business interests. They can promise workplaces, they can threaten with closure of plants or relocation, which can have considerable effects on landscape. And these are forces that are not directly democratically accountable, and this applies not least to transnational corporations. And then finally, we come to protest. Social and environmental movements that feel their fundamental values are disregarded. And these may provide a useful correction to the misuse of power in a democracy. Problems with protests are that they are regarded with scepticism by the authorities. It is often the loudest rather than the weakest who may be heard the most. Powerful protests may be undertaken not necessarily by those that are oppressed, but they may also be undertaken by powerful vested interests. And protests can sometimes turn to violence. For the landscape researcher or the landscape practitioner, in using concepts such as landscape democracy, it's important not to romanticise particular institutions of democracy, such as, for example, public participation. I'm trying to indicate here that there is a need for critique of all institutions of democracy in the interest of their better working and better understanding of how they influence landscapes. We can see a shift from authoritarian to pluralistic landscape management in theory and in terminology. But how this shift is materialised in the landscape still ultimately depends on the power relations between different institutions of democracy. Thank you.
This was approach from the other end. Do we have quick questions to Mike right now? Not now. So then I think we should follow this advice and have this 20-minute refreshment break somewhere behind the curtain, I guess.